Welcome, dear friends. My name's Barbara. I'll be your Bellminder tonight. And I hope, like me, you enjoy the sound of the bell like an old friend. A really calm, grounded, anchored, loving, good friend who brings out the best in you. So tonight we'll be talking about the title of my talk is called The Joy of an Open Hand. And we'll be talking about joy and surrender. So first we want to prepare ourselves for joy and for surrender. And the way we do that, of course, is by coming back to the present moment. When we're in the present moment, that's where joy and surrender live. So we'll start with meditation. And I think we'll start with somatic meditation, which is just simply coming back to your body. So find a place of comfort and ease, and I like to check in, make sure that my body and my mind are relaxed and alert. And sometimes, especially at this time of the day, I like to give myself a couple of nice big audible exhales. Let go of the day. Let my shoulders drop. Feeling anything that I don't need right now just kind of roll off my back. So I can truly enjoy what's really here. And I find that pearl necklace of my breathing. And I breathe in. And I breathe out. And I follow my in-breath all the way. And I follow my out-breath all the way. Breathing in, I'm aware of my whole body. Breathing out, I relax my body. And slowly I might find that my out-breath becomes longer and deeper than my in-breath, providing me a sense of safety and well-being. And we practice like this. Please take good care of yourself. Do some stretching. Oh, COVID arm. Hydrate. Be aware that you're a three-dimensional object. Be aware of behind you and below you and to the sides of you, above you and in front of you. So, dear beloved community, here we are again together in the third month of 2024. Sometimes the years just fly by, but this one seems like it's already been very full. So we remember that our focus this year is to apply the teachings in our daily lives, to explore and experiment with the many ways our teacher Tai offered us to practice waking up. We welcome Maitreya, the Buddha of love, who is the awakening of love in our own hearts. And we learn how to manifest and express this love with every breath. We've been practicing setting our intentions clearly and with focus, with the assistance of Manjushri, our Bodhisattva, who teaches us how to see clearly. We've already done a lot this year to welcome the process of transformation, revealing our true nature. And tonight we'll add two elements of true love, joy and surrender, along with some daily practices. So first, for those of you in the buddy system, how's it going with your buddy? Are you finding joy and insight by connecting with a Sangha friend? We have over 20 people participating in the buddy system. And if you aren't part of it, there will be an opportunity midway through the year to jump in. I will have a couple of suggestions later on to address with your buddy. We know that developing these spiritual friendships, we are encouraging Maitreya to show up. Maitreya can be seen wherever there is beloved community. In this way, our bodies and hearts are already being used to manifest Maitreya in our world. Here's a reminder from Coretta Scott King. The greatness of a community is most accurately measured by the compassionate actions of its members, a heart of grace, and a soul generated by love. So first, before we get into that, I want to take a few minutes to honor one of the founding members of Peaceful Refuge Sangha who died last week, Fred Tong. Fred and his wife, Mary Jane, moved into the Mountain Meadows Retirement Community in Ashland. And when the resident services staff member, who was our very own Lilibet, asked if they went to church, Hold on a minute.
Sorry, Barbara.
That's okay. So she asked them if they went to church because she was trying to, you know, find places in the community for them to connect. And they said, no, they didn't go to church, but they loved to meditate. So of course she invited them to join our seed of a Sangha, and they were steady members ever since. When Mary Jane died, we had an online service for her. And this is our recognition of Fred, along with a wonderful in-person sharing I hear that you had last week at Peaceful Refuge. There's so much to say about Fred, but we'll keep it short. Robert, would you like to say something about your old pal, Fred?
Yes. My first memory of Fred was through Mary Jane, because Karen had known her for so many years. That was in California. He was with the University of, Santa Clara University, computer science, which leads to work he later did with us in our Sangha, which I'll comment on. much later here in Ashland, 15 years ago, I worked with Fred, and he was on our board of directors in the last several years, basically as webmaster. He helped us with our current site, and he would be particularly proud of the work that we have done in connecting with the Northwest Dharma Association, because Fred really wanted to and cared about sharing the work done in our Sangha out into a larger community. He would be thrilled. I know he would be.
We found this on the web for the work done in our Sangha out into a larger community.
Well, that is Siri going nuts. Fred
that's,
was...
That's
Fred. Fred. Go ahead.
That's Fred playing a joke on us.
Well, I'm coming to that part, but he beat us to it. Fred was a writer, playwright, and a poet. He wrote a volume of all of his plays, in two volumes, actually. This one's called Seeking Point of View, available locally. And through it, he's seeking others to exchange ideas. And what better way than through our website that he was so involved with and helping us get that to be made stronger and now connecting over to this other organization. Fred was, as I wrap this up in a way that's true Fred, Fred was kind-hearted. He was compassionate, especially with Mary Jane. Karen might reflect on this, so I'll just leave it at that, but he was, and I really noticed it. He was playful, as Barbara just pointed out, with words and cool sentences. He was resolute in following through on a good idea. And he cared about me. He cared about us. And he cared about, deeply, this Sangha. Robert, bowing out.
And we're very fortunate to have Fred and Mary Jane's daughter, Charlotte, as part of our Sangha. Would you like to say something, Charlotte?
Yes, I'll say a little bit. This is Charlotte, bowing in. I'm going to just give an appreciation of one aspect of my dad and talk about something that I'm grateful for also in our relationship. And I've talked about this before, actually, in the Sangha, but I feel like I gained so much in my life. I've so admired that both of my parents were interested in self growth and spiritual growth their whole lives. And, you know, I was born when my dad was 21. So I got to see and be with some less skillful aspects of both of them as they evolved and found their natures, you know, their best selves, and they brought out the best in each other. And their whole lives, right up to the end, they were seeking and growing and wanting to find their best spiritual and their best personal and their best relationship selves. And what a wonderful example for me as their child. So that's an appreciation of admiration from my dad. And I also want to just share some gratitude because I have three siblings and we all share different things with my dad, different aspects. And I was the one that liked wordplay. We would do Wordle. He'd be really competitive with me. And I loved theater. And so my late husband and I would talk about theater and go to theater with my dad and enjoy his plays and his writing. But one of the things that was really special was, in fact, that after he moved to Ashland and became part of the Plum Village tradition, because that was something that I was doing also. And so I have this, one of the best experiences of my life was going to Deer Park for a retreat with Ty, with my mom and dad in 2009. And what a special thing that is. And just when I would come to visit, we would sometimes sit in the morning, ring a bell, and sit together for 10 minutes. And I just, it was so wonderful as he got older to be in this Sangha, so that even if I couldn't come and visit, because I live in California, I could see his face in the little square every week. So that was, I'm just giving my gratitude for that. And I think that's what I want to share today.
Thank you.
Charlotte, come out.
Well, we could go on and on, but we do have other things to go on with tonight. I just want to say that I always enjoyed Fred's quirky sense of humor, and of course his skill with writing poems and plays was extraordinary. But most of all, what I remember right now is that until a few months ago, Fred, as you said, Charlotte, attended Sangha on Zoom every week that he could. And I knew that he was quite ill at a certain point and had difficulty breathing. But when he would come online, he would sit upright, go straight into meditation, and never wavered through the whole meditation. No head nodding, no distraction. He was present. And he was such an anchor for me. I knew that if I was distracted, I could open my eyes and I could just look at Fred, and he would bring me right back. So that was a really deep appreciation that I have for him. So now Peaceful Refuge Sangha has three ancestors, Mary Jane Tong, Donna Kitchen, and Fred Tong. All of them are wonderful ambassadors. Bodhisattvas in training, carrying our hearts with them into the great beyond. Let's have a bell. So, folks, during the last practice period, were you able to prepare and or to eat at least one meal in mindfulness? This was one assignment. Could you feel how this practice connects you to all of life? Could show you in a literal sense how the entire cosmos is supporting your existence and makes the food so delicious? I hope your intention setting practice has been deep and continuous for you. You can carry this forward consciously by returning to your intention at the start of every meditation. And perhaps you've developed another time you stop during the day, like when you wake or with the first sip of your favorite beverage in the morning, when you take three conscious breaths during the day. I hope you're seeing the benefits and the joy in crafting a life that works for you, that feels like home. When we weave these mindfulness practices into our daily routines, we can feel more grounded, more anchored, like each day is a new friend. So I'd like to offer another practice for this practice period. And it's from our tradition, and you're probably aware of it, but again, it's helpful to focus on it and make it a conscious intention for this next practice period, and that's working with gathas or verses. Actually, when I was working with gathas, I came up with a name. Gatha means verse, short verse, but for me, what came up was grateful acknowledgement, and really, that was kind of something that struck home for me. So Tai told a story about how when he entered the monastery at 16, he was given a book of these gathas, or the short verses, that the monks memorized and recited as they went through their day. They were written by a Chinese ancestor, and when Tai went to France and started Plum Village, they needed updating. So he wrote a book of verses for us Westerners. It's called Present Moment, Wonderful Moment. Here's the book right here. That's one edition of it, an early edition probably. You can get it from Parallax Press or Amazon or other bookstores. In the introduction, Ty says, one way to help us dwell in the present moment is to practice reciting gathas or mindfulness verses. When we focus our mind on a gatha, we return to ourselves and become more aware of each action. When the gatha ends, we continue our activity with heightened awareness. So here are a couple of gathas from that book, and you may be familiar with them. This one says, waking up this morning, I smile. 24 brand new hours are before me. I vow to live fully in each moment and to look at all beings with eyes of compassion. So can you see that this gatha is a practice of intention setting? If you remember this gatha before you get out of bed in the morning, you're setting a powerful intention for the day. Ty suggests in the commentary that in order to remember to smile when you first awaken, you can hang something beautiful inspiring like a branch or a painting or a photo of a loved one or some words where you'll see it when you open your eyes. To me, this can be like training wheels for smiling first thing, and after a while you won't need it because smiling will be your response to a new day. Here's one more gatha from Ty, when you turn on the tap. Water flows from high in the mountains. Water runs deep in the earth. Miraculously, water comes to us and sustains all life. Ty remarks in the commentary that water is a good friend, a bodhisattva, nourishing many thousands of species on earth. Its benefits are numberless. So when you train yourself to appreciate water as it comes to you through the day, your level of gratitude and joy naturally increases and creates a good foundation for your view. And you can also make up verses for yourself. Yours might be simpler. When you open the tap, you might just say, "Thank you, water." When you open your eyes, you might just remember to smile. Or you might enjoy writing your own gatha poetry and sharing it with your buddy or another friend. So as I said, I came up with this name for them, grateful acknowledgement. This practice of grateful acknowledgement throughout the day can enhance your joy immensely. As Ty says, it returns us to the wonders of the moment, and we are renewed with heightened awareness and appreciation. So let's take a moment together and do a short contemplation. So just close your eyes and come back to your breathing. And then let come to you one simple activity or routine that is part of your everyday, like getting out of bed, brushing your teeth, smiling to yourself or to another. Let one small part of your day come alive in your memory right now. How does this small action nourish you? How does it help you to have a good day? How does it reflect self-care or care for others, care for the earth? Let a feeling or some words come, expressing the value of this small part of your day. You might notice that the joy you receive is not so small after all. So So I invite you to experiment on your own with these many little parts of our days that make up our lives. We spend much of our time doing simple things, which are rich with meaning when we're awake to them. So as I said, tonight I want to explore joy. It became evident to me at the beginning of this year that I was going to need a bedrock of joy to support me during the inevitable challenges and chaos to come. And it's proved true. I want to be clear here that I'm not going to differentiate between joy and happiness. A lot of people have different meanings for these two words, and I think a lot of it has to do with a cultural perception. We all want joy, we all want happiness, whatever meanings we attribute to them. So whatever's most comfortable to you, you can use that word. I'm mostly using the word joy because for me, it describes a feeling that's based deep in my understanding, and it arises when I'm able to be awake and present. So there are many expressions of joy to explore and develop within ourselves. There's the joy that comes with noticing the supportive conditions already in our lives, like the gathas practice, to wake up to what we take for granted and to see ourselves as endless receivers of all we're constantly being given. We need to actively cultivate this kind of joy, which happens naturally when we learn to give our full attention to the present moment. Brother David Stendhal Rass says the root of joy is gratitude. And Zen teacher Norman Fisher reminds us that joy is being thankful for life as it is. So the actor Michael J. Fox, who many years ago began dealing with Parkinson's disease, writes, "My happiness grows in direct proportion to my acceptance and in inverse proportion to my expectations." By accepting life as it is and letting go of personal or societal expectations, he continues to find meaning and happiness in his life. The first teaching I remember receiving from Thay is about nourishing our happiness, our joy. He said that if we don't balance our level of happiness with our level of suffering, we'll quickly become overwhelmed by our suffering, and we won't be any good to anyone. We can't be a bodhisattva if we're mired in suffering, and happiness and joy is the antidote. The reality is that our world, both inside us and outside us, is filled with every kind of feeling, every kind of situation. Trauma, constriction, fear, and despair, and also joy, wonder, delight, and bliss. These are the seeds that are in our store consciousness, and we all have all of them as potential. When we consciously choose to water the wholesome seeds and to not water the unwholesome ones, we are building a foundation that will allow us to be bodhisattvas, to be helpers. Now, this has nothing to do with turning away from suffering. In fact, it's the opposite. It's building our muscles so we can hold great suffering without falling apart, without losing our joy. There's an image of Buddha walking through the killing fields filled with dead bodies, wearing a gentle smile. I spent a long time confused about this image until Thay explained that the Buddha can smile in this situation of deep suffering because he knows there's more than just this. He can continue to hold all the joy and wonder of life as he's present for the suffering. Can we allow joy to be the bedrock of our view of life so that we are solid when the winds of change arrive? When you're in a situation of suffering, are you able to touch the beauty of life at the same time? I want to share a story from my life that many of you have probably heard before, so be patient with me. This story is very important to me because I realize that it's one of my moments of awakening, you know, that I can count on my fingers. An instant when the limits of my love were shredded and my heart was open to life. There's no going back from these kind of awakenings. So this was a story of about 13 and a half years ago when I was starting chemotherapy treatment. It was December 1st. And we were living in Ashland. And one of my joys has always been to decorate my house with the seasons. I take great joy in doing this. And there's no better season than winter for decorating the place. So I knew that I had no idea how I was going to feel after I started chemotherapy. And so before December 1st, we got out the 7-foot Christmas tree and packed it full of ornaments and lights. And we hung all sorts of wreaths and boughs on the mantles and all sorts of woodland creatures all over the place. And I mean, it was lights and bling everywhere. And actually, I remember I was telling Charlotte I had this memory of Fred and Mary Jane when they walked in, because we'd have winter solstice gatherings for the Sangha there. And they walked in the door at one of these times when I had decorated, and they stood there, and Fred said, "Well, it's almost too much." And Mary Jane said, "No, it isn't. It's perfect." That was Fred and Mary Jane. Anyway, so I came back from my chemotherapy, and, you know, my body was a little confused about what was going on, but I was okay. But it was a mid-afternoon, December 1st, and I had these very favorite flannel pajamas, and so I climbed into my favorite flannel pajamas, and Robert put on the Christmas music, and all the lights were on, and I was sitting there with a cup of tea, and it started to snow. And it just burst my, you know, just blew me apart, because I realized in that moment that I had to carry this belief that I couldn't be happy while I was having chemotherapy. I couldn't be happy during that. I was poisoning my body. I had to be over the other side, and then the happiness would be over there. And it just blew that apart. And it's like, no, happiness is everywhere. Joy is everywhere. Joy is right here. And it's so beautiful. So that was my story. This is how we learn to live in the joy that's not dependent on conditions. So I think I was a pretty happy child all in all. I loved to play, as children do. But as I grew into an adult, I lost some of that natural ability to play, which is a bit ironic because my graduate studies were in early childhood education. Nevertheless, I forgot them. So by the time I was in my early 40s, I suddenly realized that I didn't have any space for play in my life. I was diligently building a life of responsibility and purpose, but had left behind much of the spontaneity of joy. So I began a remedial process of consciously focusing on what brought me joy and how I could include more of that in my daily life. I had to make a list. Recently, I did the same thing. I made a list of things that bring me joy, some of which are already present in my day and some which I love, but I just don't give priority to. So then I set an intention to increase my joy no matter what conditions arose. Now I have a list of things that nourish my joy as I'm living now. And rather than just being a nice thing to do, they are the essential nutrients I need if I'm going to be resilient, flexible, and creative during these uncertain times. One of the biggest ways I nourish my joy is through beauty. For over 20 years, every January, I buy 3 primroses, which I put in a special basket and display them indoors as a reminder that spring is coming. To be present is inherently the path of joy. There's an energy of joy sustaining us when we know we're on the path, even if it's a difficult time. Joy reminds us that resistance is futile, that there's nothing wrong with our world right now, that there's nothing that needs to be changed or fixed. Service is infinite, and we get to take our place as helpers when our eyes and hearts are open. With joyful effort, there's nothing to attain. It's a true expression of our bodhisattva nature, the joy of connection. The term sympathetic joy is used when we feel the delight of witnessing someone else's happiness. This can be a useful skill to develop in our dualistic world, but underneath it all, we know that your joy is my joy, and my joy is your joy, and it's all just joy, and there's no separation. Ross Gay says, "What if joy is not only entangled with pain or suffering or sorrow, but is also what emerges from how we care for each other through those things? What if joy, instead of refuge or relief from heartbreak, is what effloresces from us as we help each other carry our heartbreaks?" So over the next 2 months, I'd like you to devote some of your daily energy to whatever brings you joy. Or maybe it's better to say, this is what I've had for many years, let boundless joy arise. As you might see, this says boundless joy arising. I've had this for many years, and I pull it out periodically and put it on my bathroom mirror, this fish coming up, boundless joy arising. Because really, joy is always here at our foundation, and we only need to return to the clear view of Manjushri to be part of this joy arising. So become part of the joy arising each day. Focus on what sparks joy in you, your meditation practice, being with children, cooking and eating, gardening and being outdoors, moving your body, challenging your mind. The list is endless. Singing. Any kind of creativity. If you're like me, you might need to actually make a list and refer to it. Or you may already be more skilled at giving joy and delight and play a prominent place in each day. So now we get to the second bodhisattva skill we're training with for the next 2 months, letting go or surrender. These are big words, big concepts, and big practice. We probably won't practice this to perfection in the next 2 months, so we won't be checking off our list anytime soon. This is the practice of a lifetime, and we're so fortunate that the teachings show us the way, as this is the key to a joyful, meaningful life. It's no mistake that in the seven factors of awakening, joy is the fifth factor, and letting go is the seventh, the last one before full awakening. A simple way I like to remind myself of this practice is the saying, reach for nothing, resist nothing. Easier said than done, hey? So in my first year of coming to this practice, the Dharma teacher Eileen Kiera said in the teaching, our practice is to make friends with what is. And this is really all I've needed to know over all the years. And of course, I'm still working on doing it. I've had an intensive course over the past 6 months with my ongoing medical issues. It's been an exquisitely designed set of challenges, fine-tuning my awareness to the many times I'm resisting what is and feeling the pain that results from that resistance. Like Michael J. Fox says, when I'm able to let go of my expectations and rest my energy on what is happening in the moment, my suffering eases and my joy increases. Why isn't this part of the owner's manual of being a human being? Oh, wait, there isn't one. So we're making one up as we go along. I've learned to come face to face with my expectations and my desire to control both process and outcome. To first resist the challenges, and then after learning to accept them, to try to manipulate them into a story with a happy ending, which means it comes out the way I want it to. So then I have to learn to let that go too. This is the joy of an open hand. When we learn to let go, our constriction around life and its conditions dissolves, and joy is what naturally arises. It doesn't arise because we've gotten what we wanted or because we've convinced ourselves of something. It comes from letting go of our ego, our identity, our separate self. It comes from letting be. This is big work. And we've already been practicing it for as long as we've been meditating. When we sit down to meditate, we remember our intention. And then we let go into whatever arises without judgment or control. My meditation teacher, Craig Hamilton, reminds us that wanting things to be a certain way distorts our perception and impedes us from responding skillfully. In meditation, as we practice letting go of wanting things to be a certain way, we can see more clearly and respond from our bodhisattva heart. In this way, we ultimately become available for something bigger to live through us. We are learning how to give up personal wanting to foster a deeper cosmic desire, one that invites us to participate in the evolution of humanity, of consciousness. We'll go into this more deeply later this year. So how do we learn to let go? There are many tools and techniques out there and several qualities that help us turn towards this transformation. We can try a few here, and I'd like you to continue to practice with those exercises that speak to you, that challenge you, and maybe the next step on your path of waking up, your path of joy. But first, what the heck? I really want my body to get better so I can live life on my terms. There, I've admitted it. And who doesn't want to feel well, to have days of well-being filled with energy and purpose and delight, so I can get out there and be a helper instead of resting and icing and managing pain? Of course I want my body to recover into a state of health. Of course there's room for this desire and intention. However, the more energy I put into wishing for this to happen, the less energy I have to truly love my body as it is right now. And love is the medicine for healing. The medicine most needed is to be fully and lovingly present with what is, full stop. Not as a method to change things, but to understand that this moment is perfect as it is. It contains all the conditions needed for a happy, joyful life. So here we are, wanting things to be different, feeling our resistance to the way things are now, and training ourselves to turn our energy towards healing, towards loving life as it is. Okay, so here's one three-step process. I'll just describe it to you. And this is a good process because it's an active process, and it's good to use when you're still wanting things to be different. You don't have to get to that place of serenity. So it combines our best intentions and our clear intention setting and our focus. It comes from a Hawaiian kahuna, and it's called EWOP. Okay, EWOP stands for everything's working out perfectly. So here's how you do EWOP. You start with what we've already been training to do. We focus on our clear intention and fuel it with our energy. Your intention is your vision for the highest outcome for all. It's not a specific strategy to get something you think would be good, even with your best intentions. Rather, it's trusting Manjushri when he tells us that no matter how clear and loving your view of things, you only see one point in the vast network. So it's not your place to figure out the method or the path forward. The energy of the universe is so much vaster than we are. There are creative solutions we can't imagine, but we can fuel them with our clear intention and love. So when you have your clear intention fueled with your volition, the energy of your bodhisattva heart, you say loudly, EWOP! And then you let go. You've done your work of seeing as clearly as you can what's needed. You've given it your wholehearted support. You've called on the universe to manifest it. And then you let go of your small personal effort and let the collective energy create what's best for all. So that's one way to practice letting go. And now let's take a few minutes to practice another way, which is a meditation on letting go. more familiar to our kind of work. So I'm going to start it with a bell and just settle in and come home to your breathing. For the next few moments, practice not needing anything to be different than it is. Rest in what is. Let what is hold you. As Tai said, this is it. This moment, as it is all we need. It's perfect. We are perfect. When we do this practice, it can reveal the more and more subtle ways we want and expect life to be different. That really things should be different. That there's a mistake here. That my body isn't quite right. That others are not the way I want them to be. We come face to face with our constant need to fix things. As these notions arise in our conscious awareness, can we make room for them? Acknowledge them as part of our false assumptions about life? Can we see our limited understanding, our belief that certain circumstances are required for our happiness, for our joy? Can we release these notions just for a few minutes? Can we reach for nothing and resist nothing? Can we simply rest in the beauty of what is? Meditation teacher Tara Brock asks, what am I unwilling to feel? This can be a potent question for us to use as a koan as we go through our day, to begin to notice what we turn away from. Most times when watching the world news, I'm very conscious of what I'm unwilling or unable to feel, and I limit my exposure accordingly. Other times, this question can lead me to insight into what I'm resisting and encourage me to release my limited view. The first step I use in becoming aware of the need to let go is to tune into my body. When I scan my body and tune into the sensations, I usually find at least one place that's constricted, that's holding tension. For me, even when I feel relaxed and calm, if I tune into my belly, there's a low-grade feeling of tightness or unrest. I've learned to just go there and be with that sensation. It's actually kind of a reliable friend. So the word dukkha is normally translated as suffering, which I think can be very confusing. And perhaps it's more accurate to translate it as a subtle constant dissatisfaction. But maybe here an even more useful translation is resistance. So in this skill of letting go, we're learning to release any resistance to life as it is. And our bodies can lead us into the mastery of that skill. A few weeks ago, I would wake in the night with my knee hurting. I had been challenging myself with the question, what am I unwilling to feel? In this way, I started to train in being present to the sensations without labeling or judging them. And then I could wake and just be with them instead of turning away. I noticed their changing nature and their variety of sensations. And one morning I woke and I had been in a dream where I had told someone I was going on a trip. And when they asked me where I was going, I said, to the box of pain. And it was as good a place to be going as any. So here's a short version of how I've been increasing my willingness to be with pain. Of course, it can be used with emotional and mental pain as well as physical pain. We're practicing here to turn towards our pain, our resistance. Tsongkhya Rinpoche says that being willing to suffer is love. We are turning towards our suffering in order to increase our ability to love what is. I'm going to hold on. Would you turn that light on? It's getting a little dark here. Great. So we're going to do one more meditation here. So again, return to your breath. We're just going to slow down and let everything be as it is. Breathe in to expand your space so you can surround any pain, any resistance with your kind, loving attention. Be present, silent, listening, curious. Not needing anything to be different. Knowing this moment is a miracle. So in this meditation, you can wait for resistance to arrive, or you can call up a familiar pain that you're holding and invite it to this moment. Something that you would rather have be different. And when resistance to what arises is comes up, gently bring your awareness into your body. Find a place that's constricted or in discomfort, or a sensation that's calling to you. Notice the feelings, both their stuckness and their changing nature, the variety and the texture of the sensations. Breathe into this part of you with loving awareness. Do it slowly and gently. Invite this resistance to speak to you, to offer its wisdom. Love brings relaxation, completeness, and allowing of things to be exactly as they are. So we can use our fist as a metaphor for tightness, our unwillingness to be with what is. We can make a fist and be aware of the tightness. If we spent several moments offering our full attention to our tight fist, that awareness itself would release the fist into an open hand. Just offering our loving awareness to our bodies enables them to let go. So what happens when the fist becomes an open hand? There's spaciousness and a letting be. There's trust, vulnerability, and the possibility of connection. If there's no resistance, the separate self dies. We find ourselves resting in equanimity, where there's room for everyone and everything. Our love is big enough to hold it all. When we can rest in equanimity, our love knows no boundaries because there's no more need for protection, for armoring the heart. Equanimity reveals our innate belonging, which is naturally awake and tender. So how do you let go of all that you want and think you need and learn to be fully content with the way things are? The wonky knee that can't walk without hurting, the inflammation effect of fatigue, the emotional roller coaster that we're all on. Here's a formula. Learning to gather all our intention and attention into what's happening right now. Touching in with our senses. Inhabiting our bodies. Letting go of assumptions and expectations. Becoming curious about everything. Joy lives there. Such an opportunity to learn to turn the mind and release the heart. Sighs of relief. Everything is here right now, regardless of the state of my knee and my body and the world. Falling in love with it by learning to love myself as I am, with passion and gentleness. Appreciating myself into wholeness. Releasing the fist, opening the heart, boundless joy arises. So, here are your assignments for the next practice period. Explore the gata or grateful acknowledgement practice. Find something creative that works for you every day. Nurture your joy every day. Practice letting go. This could be the EWOP, the meditation on not needing anything to be different, moving from a fist to an open hand. And if you have a buddy, share how joy is part of your daily practice and share what's challenging for you to let go of. So I'd like to close with a poem by Fred Tong, provided by Charlotte, written in 2022 after the death of his wife, Mary Jane, trying to figure out how to live without her. It's called There Will Still Be Joy. I can't imagine a better poem for our practice tonight, so this is truly Fred being present with us here. There will still be joy. My springtime source of joy, a way to greet each day, is viewing daffodils, starting out afresh with my morning jolt of love. I step out the door, glancing left, right, up and down. In all directions shine bright yellow clumps of spring. Their spirits buoy up mine. In summertime, just stepping early out the door is not enough. I must do more to overcome such lazy, hazy days. To seek out summer's joy, I hike to gardens where dwell towering sunflowers, tall stalks slowly turning face to the sun, encased in golden hair. Some habits ingrained by life bring us happiness. One such is each day searching out new joys in nature, family, friends. It lifts my heart to know that after I am gone, there will still be daffodils. There will still be sunflowers. There will still be joy. So I have a little confession to make. I do not time these things, but I do turn it over to Ty. And I ask him to lead, and here we are right on time. So I wanted to make space if there was anyone else who wanted to speak about Fred. Specifically, I was wondering about Karen. Robert, you mentioned her.
Karen, do you want to say something, dear?
Well, I mentioned that we wouldn't be here had it not been for Mary Jane and Fred inviting us to come to Ashland. And in that visit, we determined we wanted to live here. And so we came. What I wanted to talk about was I watched Mary Jane and Fred with each other. Their relationship was a marvel because they were so different. Mary Jane, Fred was a computer scientist, although he had a myriad of other interests. His background was in computer science. Mary Jane was quite the opposite, as a nurse and a healer. And they came from diametric opposite perspectives and positions in so many ways. And they had to really work at coming together. And I think that was a fascination that both brought them together and made them work very hard to come together into a unity. And they really worked very hard at that. And I admired how they worked over the years spiritually and every other way to transcend and come together on so many levels. So I just wanted to share that because it was worth noting that that was part of the essence of their relationship, was that journey, was that aspect of their journey together. So I wanted to mention that that was an essential part of their journeying process.
Thank you. Going out. Is there anyone else who'd like to speak? Going once, going twice. Well, we all know we have the Peaceful Refuge folks have endless stories of Fred and Mary Jane, and all wonderful. So, you know, all our dear ones, they live in our hearts. They bring us such joy. And we can, you know, make it a practice to spend some time reflecting on all that our ancestors, our dear ones, have given us. and that they live on in us through the ways that we act and the ways that we speak and the things, our attitudes, you know. They open our minds. So, okay, dear friends, shall we offer the merit of all the practice that we've had, all the beauty and the insight and the love and the sharing and the connection, all of it. Let's offer it out to our world that we know needs it so much. So, may the merits of this practice benefit all beings and bring peace. Thank you for being here. Have happy practice.
Thank you, Barbara.
Thank you, Barbara. Thank you.
That was wonderful. Couldn't have been more appropriate.
I appreciate you.
Yeah,
it was wonderful.
Do too. Yeah.
Love to you, Charlotte, and the rest of your family.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, definitely. Mm-hmm.
Thank you, everyone. Thank you. Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you, Barbara.
Barbara.
Thank you.
Thank you. It's been a wonderful evening.
It has.
Janelle. Where are you?
She's gone.